21. It was an easy question to answer. Only took a second. No. That was Erin's answer. She had not used wild or foraged mushrooms in the beef Wellingtons she had cooked. From the beginning of the trial, the defence had argued that Erin was innocent of any intention to kill anyone. But they also claimed that after the event, she had panicked due to her fear that she would be blamed for what had happened. However, the event that they themselves claimed had sparked this fear occurred a day after Dr. Laura Muldoon asked her that question. At the time she was answering Laura, on the 31st of July, innocent Erin was still saying she was experiencing lessening diarrhea, which was the tail end of a glancing exposure to whatever had been in the beef Wellingtons, and that is why she had presented at Leongatha Hospital. She was, if anything, a little bewildered and confused by what was going on. She had been told only that morning that the staff at Dandenong Hospital now suspected Don and Gail were suffering from death cap mushroom poisoning as a result of consuming the beef Wellingtons that Erin had cooked. But no one, at least not on the evidence we had heard, had given her any reason to believe they thought she had poisoned people deliberately. The health staff who were talking to her were simply desperate to figure out exactly what had caused everyone's illness, mostly to ensure their treatments were the most appropriate possible, but also to ensure that they could contain the number of people exposed to it. On that Monday afternoon, 2 days after the lunch, no one was assuming intentionality or looking to apportion blame. No finger pointing was going on at this stage. They were just seeking honesty and help. Chris and Veronica at Leongatha Hospital had both been surprised by Erin's reluctance to let her children be assessed. But during the trial, we hadn't heard anything to suggest that their surprise masked a suspicion of guilt. Certainly, even if they did have a suspicion, they had said nothing to give Erin that impression. They had merely expressed frustration with Erin's resistance to their advice. In those circumstances, how could innocent Erin reasonably explain her decision to offer a flat denial to the question of using wild or foraged mushrooms when she had, in fact, foraged wild mushrooms, dehydrated them, and stored them in a Tupperware container in her pantry? Even if she did also have next to it a Tupperware container of dried mushrooms she had bought from an Asian grocery store, why wouldn't innocent Erin, when asked the question, think, "Damn, maybe I did use those mushies that I picked back in May. Could that explain it?" It was getting harder and harder to keep presuming innocence. At so many moments in the story, there were no reasonable explanations for her behaviour compatible with innocence, and the number of those moments was growing. While Erin was tied up talking to Laura Muldoon, Sally Ann Atkinson, unable to contact Erin, called Simon. She was very keen to know if there were any other leftovers from Saturday's lunch still at Gibson Street. Simon had no idea. Did he have a key to gain entry? No, he didn't. Was it possible Erin could have picked the mushrooms herself? Highly unlikely, said Simon. He had never known her to pick wild mushrooms. Why would he? During the trial, Erin had been unusually candid about her occasional hobby of mushroom foraging. It hadn't begun until the COVID lockdowns of 2020. Simon wouldn't have known about it. By now, Erin was feeling bombarded. Following Laura, Dr. Rhonda Stewart arrived at her wardroom, also wanting a chat. Rhonda was the Director of Public Health and Infection Prevention at Monash Health, and she had been asked to see Erin by the Monash Health CEO, Martin Keogh. News had spread about the number of seriously ill people in hospital because of Erin's lunch. The brief the CEO had given Rhonda was to make sure it wouldn't extend to a public health issue outside the hospital. However, the motive behind all these probes and investigations by the various wings of the health profession still had nothing to do with blame or guilt. It continued to be about protecting public health and making sure the outbreak was contained. No one was giving any thought to any intention behind the outbreak. Not yet. Rhonda began asking Erin all the same questions that she had already answered, and so Erin described the sliced button mushrooms she had bought from Woolies, and then talked about the other pack she said she had bought from an Asian food shop several months prior. At the trial, Dr. Stewart recounted her memory of the conversation to Jane Warren. Erin said they were in a packet, a sealed packet, but she'd opened the packet and put them in another container. I asked her where she had bought them from, but she couldn't tell me exactly. She said it was a shop in either Oakley or Glen Waverley. Did you discuss whether any wild or foraged mushrooms had been used in the meal? Asked Jane. Yes, I did. I asked her if she'd been mushrooming and did she use any other mushrooms, but she said no. She only used those two types of mushrooms. They chatted on for another half an hour or so. Erin had heard that the other lunch guests were all unwell, but she didn't appear to know any more details. When she left, Rhonda swung by the emergency department and checked in with the registrars. They told her that, although the kids were staying in overnight for observation, all their test results were normal. Erin's bloods were all pretty good now as well, and she was taking a supplement to help lift her potassium level, but that was all she needed, really. Laura left Monash Medical Center knowing that Sally Ann Atkinson and the Victorian Department of Health were about to take over the search for Erin's Asian grocery store. She felt they were the people best positioned to run with that ball, and until or unless she was required again, she would take a back seat. Simon and the two kids spent several hours with Erin in her room before the kids went back to theirs. During those hours, Simon didn't see Erin go to the toilet. Not once. As far as he could see, Erin had fully recovered from her bout of diarrhea. Assuming, of course, it had ever been real in the first place. What was indisputably real was Gail's condition. She arrived at the Austin at 8 p.m. that same night. Gail was critically ill and in multiple organ failure, confirmed Dr. Stephen Warrilow. As well as beginning the full range of aggressive treatments, the same ones that Don was on, the team at the Austin ran a full battery of highly sensitive and specialised tests just to confirm nothing else was contributing to the ever-worsening condition of Gail and Don. And the results of those investigations? Asked Sarah Lenthal. We could not find any other contributing factors or alternative causes. Gail's condition and Don's was due to Amanita mushroom poisoning. By the morning of Tuesday, the 1st of August, Gail's condition was rapidly deteriorating. She was in an advanced state of multiple organ failure, with her organs essentially shutting down, and she was in a state of advanced shock, Dr. Warrilow confirmed. The Austin team were down to their treatments of last resort, and by 8:30 in the morning, they were preparing Gail to receive vitamin C and plasma exchange. Don't ask me. I never did quite follow what that was, but it was a thing. At the same time, Sally Ann Atkinson was steeling herself for a busy day. She phoned Erin and introduced herself. They talked through Erin's symptoms, and Erin described her initial attack of diarrhea on the night of the 29th to the 30th of July as ongoing and explosive. Whoa there, I thought. That's building it up a bit. Sally Ann was left with a much more vivid picture of Erin's suffering than her earlier interrogators had received. Her story was growing. Sally Ann moved on from there to the cause of Erin's physical distress that evening, the beef Wellington. Where had Erin bought all the ingredients? Well, As we knew, most of them came from Woolies. But the nub of the matter was the Asian grocery store. Now, in relation to the mushrooms that she said she purchased from an Asian store, asked Jane when Sally Ann was giving evidence, did she give you any information about that store? She said she wasn't sure where she purchased them, replied Sally Ann. She thought it could have been either Clayton or Oakley or Mount Waverley. She said she'd driven around a lot that day, so she wasn't sure exactly where she'd been. She explained that during school holidays, she would often book activities up that way, and she would take her kids up there, drop them off at their activities, and then she would drive around before picking them back up. In one sense, Erin was sounding and being as helpful as she could, and we knew that she and the kids had stayed at her Mount Waverley unit in the April school holidays. She was really trying to be cooperative. She said she didn't have the packaging anymore, but it was a small see-through bag with a white label on it, but didn't have a lot of writing on it. It was not a resealable bag, but she'd opened it for a pasta dish, except that when she opened it, she thought they smelt funny, so she then decided she wouldn't use them all, so she put the rest in a container. The detail here was convincing. Sally Ann bought it. She believed Erin was being as helpful as she could. Personally, I thought there was a good chance Erin had bought a packet of dried mushrooms from an Asian grocery store somewhere. In a way, the description sounded too accurate and detailed not to be based on some sort of half-truth. There was so much she remembered about the packaging and the labelling and... but not the shop. For the life of her, she couldn't describe anything about the shop. It was somewhere within an area of, 5 kilometres by 5 kilometres? So let's say about 25 square kilometres. Everything else was a blank. The size of the store, its windows, its signage. No idea. Couldn't remember a thing. Erin had provided just enough detail to lend the story a convincing streak of credibility, while guaranteeing there was not quite enough detail for anyone to ever actually find anything. But Sally Ann had somewhere to start, what the packet looked like. She rolled from her phone call with Erin straight into her problem assessment group meeting. Her team needed to do whatever they could to identify which store had sold these dried mushrooms, where the mushrooms had come from, and how many packets the store had sold, and whether Erin or anybody else had used them in any other meals. Organising and coordinating who was going to do what would take the next several hours. Erin had done her best to be helpful, and she was now rather impatiently waiting to be decannulated and discharged. Meanwhile, she would appreciate some company. Luckily, her sister-in-law, Tanya, Matthew's wife, had texted Erin the previous evening to ask if Erin was up for receiving a visitor. Erin had said that it'd be lovely. Around 9:30 a.m. or so on Tuesday, Tanya popped in and took a bedside seat. Erin asked how everyone was. I told her that things were going downhill quickly, but I didn't have the latest information, Tanya recalled while giving evidence during the trial. She told me that she knew that Don and Gail at least were in a coma, and I said that was the latest I knew, and if she wanted to know more, it was probably better to wait for Simon to tell her. That was Tanya's memory of the conversation. Even under cross-examination from Sophie Stafford, when Tanya was a little less certain on whether she had actually used the words going downhill quickly, she was still sure Erin knew that Don and Gail were in comas, and considering Erin had spent hours with Simon and the kids the previous afternoon and evening, that would seem likely. Unsurprisingly, however, that wasn't Erin's memory of the conversation. When Erin was in the witness box and Colin asked her about the visit from Tanya, we got the abridged version. Colin played a straight bat. And did you have a discussion with Tanya about the wellness of other people? I did, Erin declared. I asked her if she could tell me how everyone else was doing. And what did she say? She said she wasn't sure of the latest and that I should ask Simon. That was it. Simon, for his part, doesn't even remember Erin ever asking him for an update on how the others were doing, which he found odd. Wouldn't we all? Exactly what Erin knew about Don and Gail's failing health and when she learned it never did become entirely clear, but I can't for a second believe she thought they were at home putting the kettle on. She knew something was up. Erin had also told Tanya that she had been diagnosed with really low potassium and had been given some medication overnight to address that problem. Really low is an exaggeration. Her potassium levels had been a little under the normal range. Even as Erin and Tanya talked, however, Dr. Laura Muldoon came in with the results of Erin's latest blood tests. They were all normal. Her potassium was now normal. Her liver function was normal. There was no indication of any liver toxicity. There was no clinical or biomedical evidence of Amanita poisoning. Laura checked all the standard vitals, pulse, temperature, blood pressure. Erin was fine. There had been no recurrence of diarrhea overnight or that morning. No vomiting, no abdominal pain. Erin had a full hospital lunch and was discharged at 1 p.m. By that time, Gail's liver had been so badly damaged by the Amanita toxins that it had stopped working. Heather had just arrived at the Austin in a similar state. She was critically ill with multiple organ failure. Don was also getting worse. Despite the extreme measures and the full suite of available treatments being administered, Dr. Warrilow and his team were very worried. It didn't seem to matter what they did. And Dandenong Hospital had just called. Ian was also now suffering acute liver failure. His decline was following the same trajectory as that of the other three. Dandenong could do nothing more. They were also transferring Ian to the Austin in the next couple of hours. All four of them were in induced comas. The entire case for innocent Erin had been built around the proposition that the whole lunch had been a terrible accident. Whether it was dried mushies from an Asian grocer, or a Tupperware container full of foraged fungi she threw in by mistake, Erin had not known what she was really mixing in. But it could only have been an accident if she had eaten the same meal as her four guests. I've said it before, I know, but that was a key to so much. Erin, Colin Mandy and Sophie Stafford had spent weeks trying to demonstrate that this was a feasible reality. The key to them proving Erin's innocence was to show us, the jury, that it was perfectly reasonable to accept that Erin's diarrhea after the lunch on the 29th of July was real, and it was the result of Erin, in complete ignorance, also ingesting Amanita toxins from the mushroom paste in her beef wellingtons. Or, at the very least, the defence team asserted there had to be doubt, and we couldn't say beyond reasonable doubt that she hadn't also been poisoned. They argued that her symptoms were simply far less damaging because she was younger and heavier, and she had, by a fluke, consumed a smaller amount than the other four. Colin put this case most forcefully when he cross-examined Dr. Dimitri Gerostomoulos, the chief toxicologist at the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine. No Amanita toxins had been detected in Erin's blood sample taken on the afternoon of the 31st of July when she had first arrived at the Monash Medical Centre. But that was the only sample of Erin's ever tested, and that blood had been taken 51 hours after the lunch. And the doc himself had given evidence that Amanita toxins do not last long in the blood. All of that was true. Colin went further, asking Dimitri to confirm that most of the research and literature on death cap mushrooms had been undertaken in Europe and the United States. Yes, I agree with that proposition, said the doc. One of those articles that you footnoted, if I can refer you to the one that's titled Cyclopeptide Containing Mushrooms, the Deadly Ammonitis. It was published in 2017. It's a German publication by two clinical physicians who have written a review article on death cap mushroom poisoning, and they include a table which is called Severity Grading of Ammonita Poisoning. Do you see that? Yes, I do. It goes from grade 1 to grade 4, grade 1 being the least serious, grade 4 being the most serious. Yes. It says grade 1 is patients exhibit gastrointestinal phase with typical delay but do not develop via chemical signs of liver or kidney dysfunction, though other persons who have eaten the same meal may develop higher severity grade. Grade 2 says patients showed delayed gastroenteritis with a mild rise in transaminases with 2- to 10-fold upper limit, but no coagulopathy, blood clotting. And then grade 3 is patients develop severe liver injury with transaminases greater than 10-fold, plus coagulopathy. And grade 4, patients are characterized by steep rise in transaminases and a steep decline in clotting function, a steep rise in bilirubin, and a rise in creatinine after day 3. This phase is usually fatal without a liver transplant. Yes, I see that. I just want to ask you about that first one, why that might be the case, where one individual is less severely affected than others, notwithstanding they've eaten the same meal. Having asked the question, however, Colin didn't wait for the expert to answer. This point was too critical to Erin's case to risk leaving it on the table. Colin was going to guide the response in the direction it worked best for Erin. "Can I suggest these things?" he barreled on. "The first one is the amount they consumed." "Yes." "Even if they've eaten the same meal, there might be a variation in toxicity from one person's portion to another." "Yes, that's possible," agreed Dr. Gerostamoulos. "The concentration of the toxin in the meal, so the dose or the amount that has been consumed." "Yes." "The toxic response of the individual, so some people have a better toxic response than others." "Yes." "So depending on an individual's tolerance to that particular toxin or their physiological response, that may be different." "The general health of the individual?" "Yes, so that will play a role in the development of some of these symptoms." "The age of the individual might be a factor?" Colin was on a roll. "That can be a factor. And the weight of the individual might be a factor?" he concluded. "Yes, that can be a factor in terms of the amount that's consumed. Thank you, Doctor." Colin sat down, satisfied that the point had landed. Colin was relying on this one scientific paper to make us think it might just be possible that Erin had no idea what she'd put in her Wellingtons and had eaten the same meal as everyone else. She just got lucky. It can happen. Look, these Germans said it could back in 2017, although what they had actually said was that others eating the same meal may develop higher severity grade. It left open the possibility that everyone else would go straight to grade 4, but it seemed to me that would be an extreme interpretation. Sarah Lenthal, in her re-examination of Dr. Gerostamoulos for the prosecution, just had one question for him. If two adults with no serious pre-existing health conditions ate the same amount of the same meal that contained death cap mushrooms and one person died, what would you expect the health outcome to be for the person who did not die? The doctor said that it might not result in both people dying. He cited as an example a real case from the previous year when one person had died and the other had not. So that outcome was certainly possible. But the person who did not die in that case had been significantly ill for a period of time in intensive care. The health outcome was still very serious. In many ways, it wasn't unlike the outcome for Ian Wilkinson in this case. Colin tried his hardest on this point because it underpinned so much of his case. Had Aaron eaten the same meal? He just needed to convince one of us that there was the smallest chance that she might have, that we really couldn't rule it out. But here we had four people whose alarming decline in health had been identical and life-threatening, to the point where they all now needed a miracle to survive. And then we had a fifth person. All she'd needed was an extra roll of toilet paper.